Welcome, everyone. The third Freaky Friday for 2012. Suitably placed just before Valentine's Day, if you haven't figured it out yet. This is a mood-inducing Freaky Friday. Oxytocin, the so-called love hormone. Our expert at McGill is Jennifer Bartz. She was a Concordia undergrad, did her PhD here with John Lydon, psychology professor who around this time last year gave a talk right in this room. It was a Freaky Friday talk. We showed a different movie after his one. After Jennifer's presentation, we'll be showing The Notebook. We'll take a little pause in between where we can go and get a snack over at the library or something, bring it back. I'll probably be putting the movie on around 6:30, quarter to 7. Jennifer's work. Downloaded from her website. Professor Bartz is interested in the factors, both individual, difference, and situational, that facilitate or hinder the pro-social, communal behaviors that are vital to developing and maintaining close relationships. Her research is grounded in empirical social psychology, but she draws upon methods from neuroscience and psychopharmacology to better understand the neurobiological mechanisms underlying pro-social behavior. She tells me that the talk tonight is really what defines her work, and it's just everything you ever needed to know about this kind of research. Jennifer Bartz.
Thank you very much. So thank you, Ingrid, for the kind introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here today. As Ingrid described, I'm really interested in close relationships and attachment processes, and in particular, the biological basis of close relationships. So today I'll be talking about oxytocin, which is a hormone and a neuromodulator that's been implicated in attachment and bonding. And in particular, the focus of my talk today is to address, well, oxytocin's been referred to as the hormone of love, and what I want to talk to you about today is whether or not that's the case. So oxytocin is a 9-amino acid peptide hormone that's produced in a part of the brain called the hypothalamus, and it's released into the body by way of the posterior pituitary, and it's perhaps probably most well known for its role in the periphery. In particular, stimulating uterine contractions during childbirth and the milk ejection reflex to promote lactation. But oxytocin, as I'd mentioned, also acts as a neuromodulator in the brain, so it's released into the brain. And about 4 decades now of research in animals has shown that oxytocin in the brain really plays a critical role in attachment, pair bonding, pro-social behavior, socially motivated behavior, and social recognition. And most of this research has really been done in animals. But recently, in the past 10 years, there's been a surge of interest looking at the social effects of oxytocin in humans. And there's some indication that oxytocin may also play a role in human pro-social behavior. So to begin with today, I just thought I would give you a background about some of the highlights from the research that's been conducted on oxytocin in animals, because we really know much more about oxytocin and its role in attachment and bonding from the research in animals. And then I'll turn to the question of oxytocin's role in human prosocial behavior. So much of our understanding of the neurobiology of prosocial behavior comes from comparative studies of these two vole species. And on the left, we have the prairie vole, and on the right, we have the montane vole. And as you can see, these two species are very similar in many respects. They look alike, but they are very different in terms of the social behavior that they tend to exhibit. And the prairie vole, as you can see, is highly socially monogamous. So they tend to form enduring pair bonds, and they display biparental care of the young, and they share nesting responsibilities. Whereas the montane vole, depicted over there on the right, is more asocial, shows very little interest in social contact, abandons their young pretty early on in development. And so these two, this given how similar these two species are, what researchers were able to do is to conduct comparative studies and look at neurobiological differences that might underlie these differences, these pronounced differences in social behavior. So one way researchers have done this is something called the partner preference test, which is an index of attachment and pair bond formation. And how it works, how the paradigm works, is you have the experimental animal, which is allowed to mate or cohabitate with a partner. And then the experimental animal is placed in a three-chambered arena. So you can see here, the experimental animal is here in the middle. And then the partner is tethered in another chamber, and a stranger or a novel animal is tethered in a third chamber. And the experimental animal has free access to all the chambers. And how partner preference formation is measured is in terms of the time spent with the partner. And as in the wild, you can see over here, we have the prairie voles. So they spend significantly more time with their partner, huddling with their partner after that partner preference formation experience than they do either in the neutral chamber or in the stranger chamber. Whereas the opposite is true for the montane voles. Even after that period of mating and cohabitation, they spend much more time in the neutral chamber. And so basically the idea is to replicate what's really been done in what's seen in the wild in the lab. So now we have a paradigm to look at attachment and pair bonding. And researchers, in particular Larry Young and Tom Insel and their colleagues at Emory University, have done a number of studies looking at the role of oxytocin as well as the structurally similar peptide arginine vasopressin in these processes. So they administer drugs, oxytocin or vasopressin receptor agonists, and they show that that increases partner preference formation, or even more importantly, antagonists. So basically limiting the amount of oxytocin that's binding to receptors in the brain. And what's been shown is that administration of an oxytocin receptor antagonist blocks that partner preference formation in the highly social vole. And this has been taken as evidence of the critical role of oxytocin in the establishment of these partner bonds. Now, one thing that's come out of this research, and I think a particularly interesting point, is it's not the overall levels of oxytocin in the brain, but rather where oxytocin is acting in the brain that accounts for these kind of pronounced differences in social behavior. So in particular, the more highly social prairie vole has many more oxytocin receptors in regions of the brain associated with reward and reinforcement, like the nucleus accumbens, compared to the more asocial montane vole. So the idea is that oxytocin in the more social species is acting on regions of the brain associated with reward, making those social experiences more pleasurable and reinforcing. And oxytocin, this kind of differences in oxytocin receptor density in these regions of the brain associated with reward not only account for kind of between species differences, that is differences between the prairie vole and the more asocial montane vole, but also even within species differences. So this is what this slide indicates is even within the highly social prairie vole species, you can have individual differences in the density of these receptors. And what's been shown is that these differences, the more receptors there are, the more kind of pro-social behavior that you see in the animal. And in particular, what's shown in this slide is time spent crouching over pups. So before leaving the animal literature, I just wanted to highlight one other set of findings that I think are really important as we think about what oxytocin might be doing in humans. So the studies that I've been describing to you are studies showing oxytocin's role in partner preference formation, attachment behavior, pair bonding behavior. But research has also shown that oxytocin plays a really critical role in social recognition or social memory. And this is related to attachment because the attachment bonds that we form are with specific individuals. So we need to be able to identify specific individuals in order to have an attachment bond with them. And while most of this research has been conducted in rodents, I wanted to describe to you research that was conducted pretty early on the neural control of maternal behavior in sheep because I think it really nicely illustrates this process. So sheep are a very rigorous model of maternal behavior because a postpartum ewe will reject any lamb that's not her own. So being seasonal breeders and herd animals, they need to be able to very quickly and accurately identify their own offspring. And what Cavern and colleagues' research has shown is that oxytocin plays a really critical role in this process. And in particular, what their data suggests is that oxytocin appears to kind of bias neurons in the olfactory bulb to preferentially attend to social information in the environment. And in particular, so in one study, what they did, so I should just back up a little bit, the way that sheep learn about other individuals is through olfactory investigation or through olfaction. And so what these researchers did was they compared prepartum animals and postpartum animals, and they exposed them to a number of different kind of olfactory cues, both social and non-social. So non-social would be something like food. And what's shown here is the white bars are indicate the percent of neurons in the olfactory bulb that respond to these different olfactory cues. The white bars indicate the prepartum animal, and the black bars indicate the postpartum animal. And so you can see here that the prepartum animal primarily responds to and attends to non-social stimuli in the environment, and in particular, food odor. Whereas there's a complete reversal of this effect in the postpartum animal. The postpartum animal, there's virtually no response to kind of non-social stimuli and a highly selective response to social stimuli in the environment, in particular lamb odor and own offspring odor in particular. So, and what they've shown is that this kind of biasing of neurons in the olfactory bulb to attend to social information is largely due to oxytocin's actions in the olfactory bulb after birth. And I wanted to highlight these sets of findings from the animal literature and just make two points. So one that's been pretty clearly shown is that oxytocin plays an important role in kind of motivated pro-social behavior, maternal behavior, pair bonding behavior, partner preference formation. In addition, oxytocin also seems to play a very specific role modulating attention to social cues in the environment. And I think that these two points are important to keep in mind when we think about what oxytocin might be doing in humans. So now turning to the question of whether oxytocin is also involved in kind of human pro-social behavior, human attachment, human pair bonding, well, how can we address this question? As I mentioned, most of what we know about oxytocin and attachment, it really comes from research in animals. And this is because it's very difficult to study humans in this respect. So how can we study it? Well, we can study people who are showing changes in their levels of oxytocin, for example, women who are lactating. But obviously, there's a number of kind of confounds. So we have a number of other hormones that are released at that time. So it's difficult to kind of isolate or correlate the effects of oxytocin in this population. We can also measure oxytocin levels in the blood, so that is in the periphery. But one of the problems with that is, first, it's correlational. So if we know that higher oxytocin levels are associated with more satisfying or more closer attachment bonds, we don't know whether it's the attachment bond or the oxytocin level that's driving this process. But even more important than that is we really don't have a clear understanding about the relationship between oxytocin levels in the body and oxytocin levels in the brain. We don't know whether there's a one-to-one relationship there. And when we're interested in questions about social behavior, social cognition, attachment, what we're really interested in is what's going on in the brain. So ideally, one way to kind of look at the causal effects or the causal role of oxytocin in pro-social behavior is to experimentally manipulate the availability of oxytocin. But this was very difficult to do for many years. We can't just inject oxytocin into people's brains. But what's been shown is that, in fact, there's a nasal formulation of oxytocin, which is used therapeutically to promote lactation. And research with other peptides has shown that nasal delivery actually gains access to the brain. So this was very fortuitous because now we have a way to manipulate the availability of oxytocin in the brain in humans, and therefore make kind of causal inferences about the effects of oxytocin. So this nasal formulation of oxytocin was probably one of the first studies was published about in 2001 or 2002, about a decade ago. And since that publication, there's really been a surge of interest in research looking at the social effects of oxytocin in humans. There's been a fourfold increase in the number of publications on this topic. And in fact, there's been some quite remarkable parallels with the animal literature. So for example, oxytocin was shown to increase trust behavior in humans. It was shown to increase generosity in humans. It's been shown to improve mind reading, enhance the encoding of positive social memories, and also, as with the research in animals, seems to play a role in kind of social memory or the recognition of faces, making a face and memory more familiar. So these and related findings have generated considerable excitement about the potential therapeutic value of oxytocin, for example, as a possible treatment for psychiatric disorders marked by deficits in social functioning, like autism spectrum disorders, schizophrenia, social anxiety disorder, borderline personality disorder. And this excitement about oxytocin really hasn't been confined to the scientific community. Oxytocin is a pretty frequent topic in the popular press. And I think this fairly recent quotation from the New York Times really sums up the popular view of oxytocin. Above all, be thankful for your brain supply of oxytocin, the small celebrated peptide hormone that by the looks of it helps lubricate our every pro-social exchange, the thousands of acts of kindness that make human society possible. So another way to kind of describe the popular view of oxytocin right now is that oxytocin exerts a kind of main effect for any kind of hypothetical pro-social behavior, whether it's social cognition, cooperation, generosity, trust. Oxytocin compared to placebo is going to increase that behavior. And what I'm going to try to persuade you of today is that that main effect view of oxytocin more often than not is incorrect, and that, in fact, oxytocin and the effects of oxytocin in human pro-social behavior can be better characterized as an interaction. And in particular, interaction with either features of the situation in which oxytocin is administered or individual differences, that is, differences in the people to whom oxytocin is given. So I'll be describing my own research today that shows this latter effect, that is how differences in people can really modulate the social effects of oxytocin in humans. So in particular, my colleagues and I kind of reviewing the studies that have been conducted in humans to date, and then thinking about the animal work, theorized, well, if oxytocin, as I had mentioned, plays a role kind of increasing affiliative drive or the drive to connect with others, or if oxytocin modulates the salience of social cues in the environment, then one might hypothesize that oxytocin could exert very different effects depending on whom it's given. And in particular, that oxytocin might be especially helpful for those who are less socially attuned or less socially engaged, but that oxytocin may not be so helpful and might even be detrimental to those who are highly socially motivated, but who are really preoccupied with closeness and kind of chronically concerned about being rejected by other people. So in the three studies that I'm going to be describing to you today, they were designed to really test these hypotheses about how different people can respond differently to oxytocin. So in the first line of research, we were interested in the role of oxytocin in social cognition, and in particular, a process called theory of mind. And theory of mind is really important for social behavior. Basically, what it involves is our ability to kind of understand and infer the mental states of other people. So what are other people thinking, feeling, and doing? What are their goals? What are they going to do next? You can see that this is really critical for kind of navigating our social world. In order to figure out what we need to do or say next, we need to be able to anticipate what another person is thinking or feeling or what they might do. And this process is referred to as theory of mind. So as I mentioned, one study actually showed that oxytocin given by the nasal spray formulation compared to a placebo actually increased what they called mind reading, but this theory of mind process. It improved people's ability to kind of infer the mental states of other people. And this is the way. This is one way that people have tested this theory of mind process. So the idea is that a lot of the kind of social information, the most when we're trying to process social information in the environment, information that's conveyed by the eye region is usually very very salient and very meaningful in terms of trying to understand what other people are thinking and feeling. So one test to measure theory of mind is to present participants with photographs just of the eye region of human faces, and then to ask people, well, what is this person thinking or feeling? So using this test, these researchers showed that oxytocin improved this theory of mind or mind reading ability. But what my colleagues and I noticed was, in fact, that there were important kind of situational moderators of this effect. And in particular, oxytocin only really improved performance for these more difficult reading the mind and the eyes test items. So it had no effect on more easy test items. But even more importantly, other studies showed no effect of oxytocin on theory of mind or on empathy more broadly. So we suggested that this kind of variance in the literature, the fact that oxytocin sometimes improves theory of mind, or at least on some kinds of questions, and for some in some instances, but sometimes doesn't, suggested to us the hypothesis that maybe rather than working universally, that is, rather than making everybody a better mind reader, oxytocin may selectively facilitate social cognition or theory of mind given certain constraints. And returning to the hypothesis that I outlined at the beginning of this talk, the idea is that maybe oxytocin is altering specific motivational or perceptual states that make social cues more salient to people. And in fact, there is some evidence to suggest that this is the case. So one study that looked at the effects of oxytocin found that oxytocin compared to placebo increased gaze to the eye region of human faces. And again, as I had mentioned, that eye region is thought to be very communicative of what people are really feeling. So this hypothesis, if oxytocin is kind of selectively or specifically increasing attention to social information in the environment, we might hypothesize then that oxytocin would be only helpful in improving social cognition and theory of mind for those who are less socially sensitive or less socially attuned. Whereas oxytocin may not be so helpful to people who are more socially engaged. And so the aim of the first study that I'm going to be describing today is to illustrate this effect. So what we did in this study was we recruited healthy male adult participants, and we gave them oxytocin by nasal spray one day, or we gave them a placebo, basically a compound that carried all the inactive substances except for the oxytocin. And they received both. So they came in once, and then they came in again 3 to 5 weeks later. And we measured individual differences in people's kind of social engagement at baseline. And what we were interested, our outcome in this study was an empathic accuracy task. So whereas I had shown you before, one way to look at kind of theory of mind processes is to look at still photographs of the eye region. But when we're really called upon to process social information in everyday life, we're not really encountered with kind of static information. We need to, the social information that we encounter in everyday life is dynamic, it's fleeting, it's multimodal. We have to not only encode what people are saying, but their expressions on their faces, what gestures they're making. So in this study, we had participants watch video vignettes of people discussing autobiographical events from their life, either very positive events, like when their fiancé proposed to them, or negative events, difficulties in childhood. And what we asked people to do was to kind of continuously rate how they thought the target was feeling throughout the narrative. The other nice thing about this task is that actually all the people who made the narratives, all the people that we videotaped, they provided identical ratings of how they were feeling. So what we were able to do is what we measured was people's ratings of how those targets were feeling, and then we compared them to the target's own ratings of how they were feeling. And that was our index of kind of theory of mind or empathic accuracy. In contrast to the kind of popular view that oxytocin makes everyone a mind reader, what we found was that the effects of oxytocin really depended on the extent to which participants were kind of socially attuned and engaged in their environment. So I'll just carefully walk you through this slide. What we have here in this figure on the y-axis is our index of social cognition or empathic accuracy, with higher numbers indicating greater empathic accuracy. And on the x-axis down here, we have individual differences in social attunement. And what you can see is that when participants received the placebo, the less socially attuned they were, the poorer they performed on the empathic accuracy task, which is exactly what you would predict. But in fact, when those same participants received oxytocin, oxytocin selectively helped those people. So you can see that oxytocin improved their performance from when they got placebo. And in fact, they were identical to those participants who performed better on the task, who were more socially engaged. The other important finding about this study is that, as we predicted, oxytocin really didn't give people who were more socially engaged any advantages. So their empathic accuracy performance was identical whether they received oxytocin or placebo. So at least in this study, it didn't confer superhuman qualities to read the minds of others. So the fact that oxytocin was especially helpful for those who are less socially attuned, we take as evidence, or suggests at least, that oxytocin may modulate either motivational or sensory states that increase the salience of social cues in the environment. And in particular, what we showed in this study was that oxytocin, at least in this instance, was very helpful for those who were less socially attuned and less socially engaged. So the next study that I'm going to be describing to you is looking at the other hypothesis, the idea that oxytocin may not be so helpful for those who are kind of preoccupied with closeness and concerned about rejections. The idea, again, being that if oxytocin kind of increases people's desire to affiliate or the salience of social cues in the environment, it may in fact kind of exacerbate their chronic concerns. So as I had mentioned, another line of research that's been conducted in humans has been focused on whether oxytocin kind of increases trusting behavior, generosity, these kinds of things. And unfortunately, although I thought this was a very nice depiction of the experience of trust in another person, this is not typically the way researchers measure trust in the lab, or at least not in my lab. In fact, one commonly used way to measure trust experimentally is something called the trust game. And so what we're looking at here is we have participants come in and they're assigned to either the role of the investor or the trustee. And the investor gets a certain amount of money. And what they're allowed to do is they can transfer any of that money to the trustee. And whatever they transfer to the trustee is tripled in value. So if you transfer $10, the trustee gets $30. The trustee then can return any amount of that money back to the investor. So they can return nothing back, or they can return, say, the most amount of money back. So you can see that it really makes sense to trust the trustee because everybody wins. The money is tripled in value. So let's say you start out with $30. If you transfer all that $30, the trustee gets $90. If they give half back, you've now got $45. But you should really only transfer money if you think the person is going to, if you think you can trust that person to give you, to return back what's rightfully yours. So this is a widely used paradigm to measure trust behavior. And what's been shown is that oxytocin, using that paradigm compared to placebo, significantly increases monetary investments with the trustee. And that was taken as evidence that oxytocin increases trust behavior. So based on this study, we thought, well, given oxytocin's role in attachment bonding and pair bonding in animals, and that oxytocin seems to increase trust in healthy adults, might we use oxytocin to increase trust in individuals who are kind of chronically uncertain about trusting others and who have difficulty engaging in trusting cooperative behavior? And to test this idea, we recruited healthy adults as well as adults with borderline personality disorder. So borderline personality disorder is an access to personality disorder that's characterized by impulsivity, impulsive aggression, and emotional reactivity. But perhaps the most kind of salient and defining feature of the disorder is interpersonal or relationship insecurity. So these individuals are really characterized by, on the one hand, by chronic and pervasive fears about separation and abandonment, and in particular, abandonment and separation from close others and significant others. And the way they tend, and another characteristic of these individuals, and the way they tend to cope with those interpersonal insecurities, is they engage in, on the one hand, kind of needy, coercive reassurance-seeking efforts, which are often followed, they oscillate between those and then efforts to downplay the importance of closeness, or even, as I'd mentioned, kind of aggressive or aggressive acts, impulsive aggression, acts aimed at punishing significant others. So they tend to show this kind of widely oscillating behavior, being very approach-oriented, clingy, needy, and being kind of avoidance or even aggressive. And what's been shown is that while often their interpersonal insecurities tend to play themselves out in existing close relationships, these individuals show a great deal of difficulty kind of sustaining trusting cooperative behavior, even in interactions with strangers. So although studies in healthy adults would suggest that oxytocin could be used, as I'd mentioned, to increase trust in this kind of at-risk population, another hypothesis, or the alternate hypothesis, would be that if oxytocin increases our desire to affiliate, increases people's desire to connect with others and be close to others, if it modulates kind of our motivation to connect with others or modulates the salience of social cues, then the effects of oxytocin may depend on the social context in which it's given, or individual differences in the relationship representations people possess. And in particular, if people are kind of chronically uncertain and concerned about being rejected by others, oxytocin could exacerbate that. And in fact, there is evidence that context can manipulate the kind of trusting pro-social effects of oxytocin. And in particular, one study, in this study, what they did was they gave participants oxytocin or placebo, and they had them participate in engage in a paradigm that's similar to the trust game that I had described to you a moment ago, a little bit different. But then they did it under two conditions, one in which they met the partner that they were going to be having to trust or exchange money with, and one in which it was a complete stranger, somebody they'd never met before. And what this slide shows down here is that when they've met the person before, they're interacting with somebody they know, oxytocin shows the similar kind of increase in trusting cooperative behavior. So you can see right here, the black bar are people who received oxytocin. The white bar are the people who received placebo. When interacting with somebody they've met before, oxytocin increases that trust, as has been shown. But when participants are interacting with a complete stranger, somebody they don't know, somebody they don't know what they can expect from, in fact, oxytocin significantly decreased the likelihood that people would cooperate or trust the other person. Again, suggesting the importance of kind of contextual factors or things in the situation that might convey information about whether or not somebody's likely worthy of trust, and the fact that oxytocin might heighten people's attention to these social cues. So we theorize that by the same token, so that study showed, you know, manipulating things in the situation to indicate that somebody might not be trusting, while oxytocin actually decreases trust in that. We thought, well, by the same token, oxytocin might exacerbate kind of chronic interpersonal insecurity. So for people who are kind of chronically mistrusting, oxytocin may make that even worse as opposed to better. So these were the two hypotheses we tested. And in this study, we had, again, our healthy adults and our adults with borderline personality disorder who are more typically kind of mistrusting of others and concerned about interpersonal interactions and being rejected and who have difficulty with cooperative behavior. And we gave them oxytocin or we gave them placebo. And then what we used to measure cooperation and trust was a social dilemma game, which is a variation of the classic prisoner's dilemma game. So what participants experience is they come in to the lab and they meet the other person that they're going to be interacting with, and we tell them you're going to play a series of rounds of this game, and you just have to choose strategy A or strategy B, and there's different monetary outcomes that are associated with each of these strategies. And in particular, so you'll choose strategy A or strategy B, and so will your partner. So importantly, how much money you make in the game is a function of what strategy your partner chooses and what strategy you choose. And in this particular variation of the game, it really emphasizes trust. So people make the most money when they choose the cooperative strategy and when their partner chooses that cooperative strategy, strategy A. They both make $6. But if participants choose that cooperative strategy A, but their partner does not, they make nothing. They make $0. And the reason why we chose this game was we thought it would really make salient the kinds of trust issues that are at the heart of borderline personality disorder. So what we did is we had participants, again, they played three rounds with another participant, a confederate, a person, an actor whom they met, but who played from a separate room. And then on each round, they indicated what strategy they would choose. And then we asked them, well, what strategy do you think your partner chose on that round? And that was our index of kind of partner strategy expectations or trusting behavior. And then we presented them with a hypothetical scenario. We said, if you knew for sure your partner was going to cooperate or choose strategy A on this round, what strategy would you choose? And the reason why we added that hypothetical scenario was to tease apart kind of more self-protective motivations for defecting and more kind of aggressive or impulsive-aggressive motivations. So you can see here that according to the matrix, people can defect for two reasons. They can defect down here if they think that their partner's going to defect. That makes sense. If you think your partner's going to defect, you choose that strategy because at least you make $2 as opposed to the $0 you would have made. But participants in our hypothetical scenario know for sure their partner is going to choose strategy A or cooperate. So defecting in that hypothetical scenario, we thought would be more indicative of kind of an impulsive, aggressive, or punishing response, because you're basically reducing your partner's earnings from $6 that they would have made had you cooperated to $0 that they're going to make now that you defect. And it's also, I would note, an irrational response because it costs you $2 to do that. In addition to measuring kind of cooperation and trust, we also measured just general feelings of kind of affiliation, feeling friendly. And we measured that when people first arrived to the lab and then after they got the oxytocin or after they got the placebo. And what you can see here is that for everybody, people who received oxytocin reported feeling more friendly, more kind of good-natured, more friendly, than those people who got placebo. And I might also note that our patients with borderline personality disorder, there was also what we call an affective group. So those people also reported feeling especially friendly. And this is very kind of classic of the kind of behavioral profile that you see when there's the opportunity to kind of socially engage. You get this real strong kind of desire for connection and kind of desire for affiliation in this population. But unfortunately, this kind of these feelings of friendliness did not translate to kind of more trusting or cooperative behavior once participants entered into the context of that social dilemma game, when they were having to make choices and kind of think about what the other person might do. And in fact, what we found was that oxytocin significantly decreased trusting expectations in our borderline participants. So when they got oxytocin, they actually felt significantly less trusting of their partner in the context of that assurance game than when they received placebo. And similarly, oxytocin, a very similar pattern of results was observed in that hypothetical cooperation scenario. So when our borderline participants received oxytocin, they were actually significantly less likely to cooperate in the context of that scenario than when they received placebo. So again, this is in stark contrast to the data in healthy adults showing that oxytocin can increase trust behavior. What we're finding here, at least in this particular population, is that it's decreasing trust behavior. And again, I would suggest that I think we can rule out this idea that oxytocin is causing people to be more self-protective and that this is more indicative of kind of the impulsive aggression that our participants with borderline personality disorder often exhibit in the context of kind of interpersonal interactions. As I had mentioned, they tend to oscillate between, on the one hand, kind of approaching others and needy, coercive reassurance-seeking efforts, but then they kind of back off and feeling vulnerable, lash out at others. And this might be indicative, or oxytocin might be kind of accelerating that process. So again, in contrast to the popular view, we found that oxytocin did not make everybody feel more trusting and pro-social. Although we did find that oxytocin kind of initially increased desires to affiliate, how that kind of played out in the context of more complex social behavior really depended on what people brought to the situation, and in particular, individual differences in kind of relational histories and expectancies that people brought. And we suggest that perhaps by activating affiliation, oxytocin may kind of trigger chronic interpersonal expectancies and interaction patterns, in particular in our borderline participants. So the last study that I'm going to be describing to you today is following up on this idea that oxytocin may be kind of activating the affiliation system or activating the attachment bonding system, but that this may produce very different effects depending on kind of the nature of that system. So as we've learned about, oxytocin really plays a critical role in attachment bonding in animals, and it's involved in kind of in childbirth in humans. And may be a very good candidate to support kind of the biological basis of attachment in humans. So in particular, research on attachment theory, research by John Bowlby, has suggested that we develop these attachment bonds with our primary caregivers very early in life. And these attachment bonds really function to keep that primary caregiver close by and protecting of the individual. And infants really are very defenseless, and they need an older adult close by to ensure their survival. And according to attachment theory, these bonds are so critical for survival that they're thought to really, there must be a biological mechanism to support these bonds. And oxytocin, as I mentioned, given its role in attachment bonding in animals, and in fact that it's involved in kind of childbirth and lactation in humans, is a good candidate to support these attachment bonds or attachment representations that we form of our primary caregivers. And indeed, one hypothesis that's been suggested in the animal research is that social contact triggers the release of oxytocin, and that, as I had mentioned, orients attention to social stimuli along with the hedonic properties or the rewarding properties of that social stimulus. So we wondered whether oxytocin might similarly support the kind of attachment representations that humans form with their either their primary caregiver or with their significant others. And the way we looked at that, or the way we tried to test that idea, is we administered oxytocin or a placebo, and then we measured recollections of maternal care and closeness in childhood. And again, these are thought to be two key features of the attachment bond. The idea is that we form these representations of how caring mom is, how reliable she is to provide care to us. And we hypothesized, again, in contrast to this kind of popular view about oxytocin, rather than positively biasing or making everybody remember their mother in a more rosy light, we thought if oxytocin really plays a role in kind of activating the attachment system, then the effects of oxytocin on these recollections or on these attachment representations should really depend on how securely attached people were. And that oxytocin might modulate these memories or these recollections in a positive or negative direction, depending on people's attachment style. So to test this idea, we recruited, again, healthy adults, and we administered oxytocin and a placebo. So participants got both oxytocin one day, and then they got placebo another day. And then we measured individual differences in how securely attached they were at baseline. And then we asked them, after they received oxytocin and after they received placebo, think back to your childhood. And in particular, tell us how caring your mother was in childhood. And in order to minister this, we used a widely used measure called the parental bonding instrument. And in particular, participants were asked the extent to which their mom spoke to them, for example, in a warm and friendly voice, was affectionate to me, frequently smiled at me, could make me feel better when I was upset. And again, participants indicated these items as they remembered their mom in their first 16 years of childhood or of life. And to measure perceptions of closeness with mom, we used the inclusion of other and self scale, which is a pictorial scale that just measures the overlap between kind of self and other. And again, we also asked that in terms of how they remember their mom, how close they felt to their mother in childhood. So these are the last statistics that I'll be describing to you today, but just to carefully kind of walk you through this. So participants came to the lab twice. So what we did was that allowed us to compare each participants when they received oxytocin to themselves. So they served as what we call their own experimental control. So what this allowed us to do was to create different scores for our indices of memories of maternal care and memories of maternal closeness. So what we did was we subtracted participants' memories of maternal care and closeness when they received placebo from when they received oxytocin. So how close did you feel to your mom when you received oxytocin? How close did you feel to your mom when you received placebo? We subtracted the placebo day ratings from the oxytocin day ratings to calculate kind of a different score to look at the change. And so because of the way we subtracted this, positive numbers on this outcome variable would indicate that more positive recollections of mom after received oxytocin. So remembering their mom is more caring and more close in childhood when they received oxytocin compared to when they received placebo. A score of 0 would show no change. And a negative value would indicate that they remembered their mom as less caring and less close when they received oxytocin compared to when they received placebo. And what we found, again, was no kind of main effect of oxytocin on these maternal recollections. It wasn't that everybody remembered their mother as more caring in childhood. But what we found was, as we predicted, that the effects of real oxytocin on these memories about mom really depended on how securely attached people were in the first place. So on the y-axis here, we have our change score. So positive numbers here, 0 here, and negative numbers here. And on the x-axis, we have individual differences in the extent to which participants felt anxiously attached to their mom. That is, the extent to which they felt their mom, they wanted to be close to their mom, but felt that their mom wasn't always available and as close as they would have liked. Higher numbers indicate greater attachment anxiety. And what you can see is that for participants who were more securely attached and less anxiously attached, they really had a positive score. So they, in fact, when they received oxytocin, remembered their mother as more caring in childhood compared to when they received placebo. Whereas the exact opposite was true for more anxiously attached participants. When they received oxytocin, they remembered their mother as less caring and less close in childhood when they received oxytocin compared to when they received placebo. And a very similar pattern of results were observed for our index of kind of how close they felt to their mom. So again, kind of in contrast to the popular view, oxytocin didn't make the average participant remember their mother in a more glowy light or remember her as more caring and close. But rather, the effects really depended on the nature of people's attachment bond with their mother. And we think these results are striking because this index of maternal care is shown to be very stable. And really, we don't know of any kind of phasic manipulations that influence people's recollections in quite this way, which suggests to us that oxytocin may be really involved in these kind of, in the biological substrate of these attachment representations. And we had a number of kind of control indices. We measured mood and self-esteem and perceptions of other types of relationships. And oxytocin's effects were really specific to that attachment bond that we were looking at. So we would suggest that by activating the attachment system, that oxytocin may be activating the attachment system. But the consequences of this really depend on the extent to which people's kind of attachment-related goals, that is, their goals for closeness and their goals for care, have been met. And for more securely attached individuals, oxytocin may have kind of selectively brought to mind instances in which mom was particularly caring and close. Whereas for more anxiously attached individuals, oxytocin may have kind of further fueled their yearnings for closeness and the perception that mom wasn't available when they wanted her. So kind of returning to the original idea of this talk, these data at least suggest that oxytocin, when we're looking at kind of complex human pro-social behavior, doesn't exert simply a main effect. It doesn't make everybody feel more kind of trusting and pro-social, empathic, that in fact the effects of oxytocin are very dependent on the individual to whom it's given, and that we found that oxytocin, on the one hand, was very helpful to those who were kind of less socially attuned, less socially engaged, but oxytocin wasn't so helpful for those who were more kind of socially preoccupied or highly anxiously attached or participants with borderline personality disorder. And, you know, these, I think, findings have both kind of applied as well as theoretical importance. So, as I mentioned, there's a lot of excitement about oxytocin, possibly using oxytocin as a therapeutic. So kind of understanding how individual differences can moderate the effects of oxytocin, how the context can moderate the effects of oxytocin, I think will really help us kind of judge for whom oxytocin could be expected to kind of improve, leave unaltered, or even worsen pro-social behavior, cooperation, and social cognition. But my interests are more in the theoretical question, and I think one thing these data suggest is, or they prompt us to do, is to address the more question about the more basic mechanisms by which oxytocin might be acting in humans. It's quite unlikely that oxytocin is this kind of social panacea or pro-social enhancer. And what we're working on now is, in particular, looking at more basic mechanistic questions and focusing on three questions in particular. The idea, as I alluded to, that oxytocin kind of increases a very basic motivation or desire for closeness in people, but again, that this gets played out very differently depending on what people bring to the situation and what kind of expectancies they have. Another idea is that oxytocin may be modulating the salience of social information in the environment, or that oxytocin might be decreasing social anxiety. And finally, another question, I think. So the research that I've been describing to you, what we've done is we've given oxytocin to people, and we've given placebo, and we're trying to look at, well, what does this influence? What kind of causal effects does this, what kind of causal effects do we see here? But what we're really trying to understand is oxytocin's functioning, kind of how oxytocin functions in the system. We all have oxytocin in our systems. We all have oxytocin receptors. They're in different places. And it might be that kind of these individual differences that we're seeing in how people respond to oxytocin could reflect more basic differences in the underlying endogenous system. So just to conclude, I think that the idea that oxytocin could be kind of used as a love potion or a social panacea may be a bit simplistic. And that being so, oxytocin may very well be kind of the hormone of love and attachment. It definitely appears to play a role in these processes. But it doesn't necessarily make us all kind of more loving and more pro-social. And oxytocin, like love, I think, is complicated. So just to thank all of the people who really played a critical role in kind of the studies that I presented to you today. And thank you for your time and attention.
And we thank you. Was it a loving gift from the Red Pack?
Thank you.
We have time for questions.
Any questions?
Oh,
sorry. Okay, yeah.
Is oxytocin currently being prescribed or used with autistic children or patients?
Well, that's a really good question. So oxytocin, at least the nasal formulation of oxytocin that we used in our studies and that most people are using in studies with humans, isn't commercially available in North America. It is, however, available in Europe. And the way we run the way we conduct our studies is we have to get regulatory approval to import it. My understanding, though, is that people appear to be able to get oxytocin in the United States, and I have heard of a number of instances of people trying to use it therapeutically off what we call off-label because it hasn't been indicated. And, you know, this is a really, although there seems to be promise for oxytocin as a potential therapeutic to kind of increase, attention to social information and disorders like autism and schizophrenia, we really don't know a lot about its effects, especially developmentally. And most, obviously autism is a neurodevelopmental disorder. And people, it's my understanding at least, that is being conducted. So I do think that there is a large attempt, though, to conduct, kind of real clinical trials where oxytocin is given on a daily basis for a period of time to really in a number of people to really look at safety and efficacy. But I've heard that is being done, and so really more research needs to be done, though, to look at the safety of it. Yeah.
Is there any evidence that reception to oxytocin, so whether it's a number of receptors or sensitivity to those receptors, is it heritable, so that, say, parents who are more pro-social will have more pro-social offspring?
So I don't know about the question of heritability, but unfortunately, we really don't know a lot about where the receptors are in humans because we don't really have the tools to look at that. We do know, as I mentioned, a lot about where the receptors are in animals. I think we're getting closer, but not quite there yet. But one... I don't know if this is exactly going to answer your question, but another line of research looking at kind of oxytocin's role in human social behavior and social cognition has been to look at polymorphisms of the oxytocin receptor gene in humans. So you can look at kind of variability in that gene, and in fact, there's been a number of studies that have been published, and again, in the past 10 years, linking one particular single nucleotide polymorphism of the oxytocin receptor gene with sensitive parenting, dispositional empathy, behavioral empathy, a number of kind of indicators of social sensitivity, if you will. Now, we really don't know, so it's interesting that it happens to be with the oxytocin receptor gene, which might, influence that kind of thing. But we don't know whether, I think that research really needs to be taken with some caution because we don't know whether there's any kind of functional consequences. Nobody knows what the consequences are of having that particular polymorphism, whether it really influences where the receptors are in the brain. But I think the findings, from the genetic studies are really intriguing. And in fact, there's been a number of kind of really interesting studies.
What is the role of oxytocin in our sexuality? Is it true that while mating, oxytocin goes up?
My understanding of that literature is that the results are a little inconsistent. So some studies, I think, have shown increases in oxytocin following orgasm or, during sexual encounters. Other studies haven't shown that effect. So that's my understanding of that literature, is it's a little more ambiguous.
I read something by Helen Fisher, anthropology, and she speaks of
in speaking of sexual relationships or attraction, dopamine being the first, then oxytocin, then vasopressin, that you go through a series of stages, and that they're almost, you know, they usually last for 3 to 5 years, which is why people have a high, you know, and then it changes.
So that's an excellent point. I mean, this, you know, one thing I didn't, I mean, oxytocin, there's huge interactions with a number of other neurotransmitter systems, the dopamine system, the opioid system, vasopressin, which I kind of alluded to at the beginning of this talk, is a very structurally similar peptide that's been shown to play a role in also, you know, in social behaviors. There's some suggestion that there are sexually dimorphic effects. So the vasopressin plays a more important role in kind of male prairie voles' social behavior. But, you know, that's an excellent point. And again, it's really hard to study these kinds of questions in humans because we don't have the kind of tools where we can really control all of those other variables. But, you know, I think that's a central idea with this, the link with kind of, you know, if oxytocin is somehow modulating motivations and, you know, reward, it's quite likely that it might happen in conjunction with the dopamine system.
Hi, so I was wondering if there's been any research regarding oxytocin levels in people who are extremely trusting. I know that there's some sort of data that really escapes me right now, but I just wondering what the relationship there is.
So people, there have been a number of studies that have measured kind of oxytocin levels in the body. And my understanding of that literature is that, again, I think the results are a little inconsistent. So sometimes you have higher levels being associated with, you know, more being more social, having better social types of relationships. Whereas some other studies show that higher levels are actually associated with kind of more perceptions of interpersonal distress, so being dissatisfied with your relationships and having gaps in your relationships. I find those findings really interesting because what, again, it may be suggesting is that these levels could be tracking with something more basic like people's desire, you know, to affiliate or their kind of social sensitivity, but depending on, you know, how healthy their social climate is, how healthy their social network is, it could produce these very different perceptions. If you've got an intact relationship and a good, healthy marriage, well, you know, higher oxytocin levels, you know, could be very helpful in that regard or could be very pro-socially promoting. But higher oxytocin levels in a context where you are very dissatisfied with your relationships could just make you all the more aware of that dissatisfaction. But that's my, you know, my thinking on this. I think the research on the plasma levels is still, there's some variability in that research.
Do you think there's a link between release of oxytocin during lactation and postpartum depression in women who have borderline personality disorder?
I don't know. I do know that people are very interested in that question, the link between oxytocin and postpartum depression. And I'm not aware of, you know, studies that have been published yet on the findings from that. But, you know, kind of given oxytocin's role in bonding and, you know, the changes that happen over pregnancy, people have been very, very interested in that question. So I guess we'll have to wait a few years to find out. Yeah.
All right. So oxytocin is apparently a secreted hormone during pregnancy, correct? Now, I was wondering, the topic of, you were mentioning the glomerular nasal organ at some point?
I didn't mention that, but I was mentioning the research in animals, right, with olfaction and how they form memories.
I was thinking of the accessory factor involved, as in pheromone reception. If oxytocin is secreted polypeptide, perhaps, has there been any study that it could be received through gas dispersion, kind of like pheromone for humans, is the thing. Or in pheromones, when they're received, induce an endocrine response to release oxytocin in someone else.
So, with respect to your first question, I think people, I don't study that in particular, but I have heard of researchers, you know, looking at that that very idea. With respect to the second part of the question, though, there was really a fascinating study by Ruth Feldman, who studies she studies oxytocin levels and parenting and oxytocin levels over the course of pregnancy, but in particular not only in women but also in fathers. And she has many, many studies linking, you know, oxytocin levels with kind of synchrony with the child, sensitive parenting, really nice research. But the one study that that your question reminded me of is she actually administered oxytocin by nasal spray to the fathers, had fathers interact with their children, and then found that, not surprisingly, the father's oxytocin levels rose, but so did the child's. So, you know, you'll have to go, you know, if you're interested, you should go read the paper to think about how, you know, she's thinking about the particular mechanism. But I found that to be particularly striking and a provocative finding. So obviously the kid did not receive oxytocin, but the father did, interacted with the kid, and the child's oxytocin levels rose. Right. No, it doesn't. I mean, I don't think it really supports that, but the idea that, you know, how this might be, you know, translated into social interactions.
The dosage, not to be too technical, but if you actually have to shove a substantial amount directly into your nose, your nasal cavity, does that make it terribly unlikely? Because pheromones are quite potent. Sometimes a factor response is quite potent to just a few molecules.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of oxytocin, you actually have to get into your brain. Yes, it has to. Does it cross the blood-brain barrier?
Well, so I mentioned that there was a study not with oxytocin, but with insulin and with vasopressin, where they administered it nasally, and then they measured CSF levels. And found increases, and that was really taken as support for the idea that this nasal administration could modulate oxytocin levels in the brain. I think my understanding is that there's, you know, my research doesn't particularly focus on that aspect of it.
But if it's secreted, say, like pheromones, is very potent, as opposed to administering it into a direct nasal spray, does that, just because you're aware of the dosage, does that kind of discount the possibility that it's a secreted pheromone like polypeptide, or it can work in that way, sympathetic responses was observed in the study? Just thinking of the dosages.
Right. Well, I mean, I think another area where people are really looking at is what are the effects of these different types of dosages.
Two more questions?
Yeah.
I got a question. I just want to see if I get that right. It seems that also dosing hormones make you more like aware of socially, but doesn't really change the personality of the person, for example, the borderline.
Right.
Basically, just a facilitator, not any. So, I mean, basically, just facilitator, but doesn't have any more effect.
So, what we think is that it could be, that it could be modulating these more very basic processes. So, kind of increasing people's attention to social information in their environment, or making them more have a stronger desire to kind of affiliate and connect with other people. So it could be having these very basic effects. But the way that gets translated really depends on these kind of, more complex cognitive, expectancies and histories that we bring to the social situation. So what's that?
Not going to change who you are.
Right. Well, at least in the context of in our borderline patients, it didn't particularly change who they were. For other individuals, though, it did seem to, if you were not very socially engaged, it kind of brought them more up to normative levels. So I think it depends. It depends on what the particular deficit is, I would argue.
Yes. Are you aware of any studies or consideration for using it as therapy? cetera?
I'm not aware of anything being done in the context of Alzheimer's, but that I'm not personally aware of that. It could be the studies that I'm aware of are more in, as I'd mentioned, autism spectrum disorders, schizophrenia, and social anxiety disorder. And there's some interest also in the context of depression.
We're going to finish up with the formal questions, and then you can talk to Jennifer after, and we'll close down the camera. So one more.
Does it correlate in any way into the age and the stage of, I guess, social development in an individual? Because, I mean, like, let's say a child or a baby, right? The level of oxytocin in their brain, would that grow, or like, I mean, would it, I don't know, the receptors grow over time, and it depended on the environment that they're in and how social contact, how much social contact they have, and those variables, I guess?
Right, so not a lot obviously is known about this from research in humans, but there is quite a bit of research that has looked at kind of the quality of the social environment, and that's been able to kind of look at developmental changes in oxytocin, and in particular how that changes with respect to the social environment. One study that, you know, some of the research in this area has looked at, so one study that was conducted by James Winslow and his colleagues, looked at very early kind of negative early caregiving experiences in monkeys. So they had nursery reared monkeys and mother reared monkeys, and they found that in those more kind of socially deprived monkeys that there were kind of differences in oxytocin levels in the brain, and in particular lower levels in the brain, and that then influenced their ability to kind of appreciate or gain, utilize social support in their environment to modulate stress.
Do you use therapeutic sort of over time? I mean, if like let's say like through, I guess from like a young age over time to develop a sort of greater personal connection in an individual, like I don't know, like a superhuman or whatever. I don't know.
Right. I mean, I think there's a lot of questions about whether about kind of daily administration of oxytocin as a therapeutic, and how might that affect, you know, receptors, and whether that might kind of, you know, downregulate the receptors, influence the sensitivity of the receptors. And there, you know, just isn't a lot known about that in humans. But I think it's a really, really an open question. So there's one question is about, you know, giving oxytocin kind of over a long period of time, and what are the effects of that, and how might that, you know, what might happen as a consequence of that. But another question that you were asking also is just about developmentally how the endogenous system changes and how it changes as a function of the environment.
Thanks, Dr. Bartz. You've really given us a lot to think about.